Valley Metro has named a new interim chief executive. The agency's former head is under investigation for spending irregularities. Now the agency is trying to move on.
Our job is not to change what happened. Our job is to make sure that people understand that regardless of what happened, we will fix it. We will do what we can to change it.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, rural career ed programs worry about the governor's budget proposal, why science could help Arizona diversify its economy.
Looking back at Scottsdale's effort to preserve its open desert.
And a movie about a dream to play in the NFL.
It really isn't about the sport. It's about, you know, these kids, the pressures of media attention, family, and friends.
Plus, why some Valley residents are letting strangers into their homes and fast performance art.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. We'll stay partly cloudy through the rest of this afternoon around the valley, looking for a high temperature to get close to 73. And then we'll start the weekend off tomorrow, partly cloudy skies with a high of 72. Currently, relative humidity is at 12%, and it's 70 degrees.
A photo of Ahwatukee students depicting a racial slur is sparking outrage in the community and online. KJZZ's Will Stone reports the controversy began today when the photo first appeared on social media.
Six smiling seniors stand side by side, sporting lettered T-shirts. Together, they spell out the racial epithet, usually described as the N-word. Two shirts bear asterisks instead of the middle letters. The seniors, all female, had just come from the Desert Vista High senior class photo, a yearly tradition where students pose together and portray various phrases, all of which are pre-approved by the administration. The offensive photo quickly made the rounds on social media, with many calling for the students to be kicked out. Tatum Brimley is a senior at the school.
Everyone is angry and ashamed. People are ashamed that they go to Desert Vista right now, graduating with them.
Brimley says as an African-American, she sometimes doesn't feel as accepted at the Ahwatukee school, which is majority white. A school spokesperson says the administration is outraged and the behavior will not be tolerated. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Valley Metro was hit by a scandal late last year when then-CEO Stephen Banta resigned following accusations that he misspent thousands of dollars in public funds on meals and travel. Now the agency has turned over its leadership to former Mesa Mayor Scott Smith, who will take on the interim CEO tag on February 1st, and he joins me now. Mayor Smith, why did you accept this position?
I'm a big proponent and fan of our transit system. And it pained me when I saw Valley Metro going through the troubles that it's gone through. And I just felt that this was something I could do, if only for a short time, to possibly help restore public confidence and trust in a system that has served this area well. And so when asked, I said I would be willing to take it on.
Do you think that is going to be an issue, even if it's short term, that there is public perception that has hurt the organization? Or do you think that is more focused on the former CEO?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. A lot of it will be determined by the results of the audits. There are a multitude of audits that are ongoing, and whatever those audits say will, I think, decide and determine what the public thinks of Valley Metro. Our job is not to change what happened. Our job is to make sure that people understand that regardless of what happened, we will fix it. We will do what we can to change it. And we will have an organization that's not only transparent, but that returns to its core mission, which is to serve the citizens of Metro Phoenix and do it in a way that's honorable and that's ethical and that's efficient and effective. And so that's our task. And we'll find out when the audits come out.
And you were a strong advocate of light rail and have been for a long time, at a time when maybe certain people in Mesa weren't. Do you think that the success of light rail overall has surprised people? And do you expect there to be major expansion continuing all around the valley? Do you think some opponents will drop their guard a little bit, or do you think there's always going to be an element that feels like, I still need to see more?
Well, there will always be elements that don't like transit in general, and light rail especially. But I think that the success of our overall system, which follows what's happened in other cities, means that there will always be, I believe, a hunger for expanded transit and expanded rail services. That desire to expand will be met with the realities of the economy, finances, and things like that. So this is a long-term proposition. I think we'll continue to see success on the system. We'll continue to see increased ridership, economic development. But the realities are that these systems cost a lot, and I'm not sure how quickly we can expand on a system when we have the challenges that we do to our finances. And there are other competing needs that will take many of, and rightfully so, take many of the those resources, such as education.
How quickly do you think you could put, or the Valley Metro can put, this so-called scandal in the rearview mirror?
You know, that's going to take time, and it's going to take the public really regaining trust. I hope that's sooner rather than later, but we'll just keep working. And when the public believes that they can trust Valley Metro, they will. I'm not going to worry about when that'll happen. I do worry about that will happen. And my objective is to make sure that we don't give them nothing but positive experiences, so they can truly believe and trust in their rail and their bus systems.
Former Mesa Mayor Scott Smith, he's now the interim CEO of Valley Metro. Scott, thanks as always.
Thank you, Steve.
Arizona's career and technical education programs have seen millions of dollars in cuts over the past few years. In his budget proposal for the upcoming fiscal year, Governor Doug Ducey sets aside some money for these joint technical education districts, or JTEDs, but not as much as had been cut and not in the same form as before. Jeremy Plum is the superintendent of Mountain Institute JTED in Prescott. Jeremy, what do you think of the governor's proposal?
We are very grateful for the governor's efforts to restore funding to the JTEDs across the state of Arizona. But we did have a lot of concerns with the proposal that came out of the governor's office. First off, and probably the biggest concern that is shared by my JTED colleagues and myself, is that the governor restored $30 million to JTEDs over a three-year period. That's only $10 million per year, and it was done in the form of competitive grants. The cut that the JTEDs are trying to get repealed and put back into place was a $30 million per year cut. So over that same three-year span, that would be a $90 million cut. So while the governor's budget restored $30 million, it still left the JTEDs with the $60 million deficit to try to overcome over the next 3 years. The second major challenge with that cut is that it provided a $30 million grant that required a partnership between private business and industry and the JTEDs. Well, that really puts rural Arizona JTEDs at a disadvantage due to the lack of business and industry partners in the rural areas of our state.
In your mind, does that make it less likely that rural JTEDs like yours would even have access to the $10 million that would be available each year?
Absolutely. In my opinion, I think that really gives the urban areas of Phoenix and Tucson an advantage in the grant cycle, and would really leave rural Arizona left without many options to pursue. And there are some of the JTEDs that will be hit hardest by the cuts that the legislature put into place in the last legislative session.
How has your institution been affected by those cuts?
Well, for Mountain Institute JTED, we will see a $334,000 cut due to the budget cuts last session. That is without taking into consideration the passage of Prop 123, which also impacts the JTEDs equally. So if you combine those two items together, we could be facing a deficit as big as $434,000 for this coming school year. For my little old JTED with a $2.2 million budget, that is a significant blow and will force us to not only lay off additional staff, but also close central campus buildings. And right now my board is considering closing three central campus locations.
Have you had to cut programs or lay off staff in the previous couple of years as some of these cuts have been taking effect and as the recession has hit?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, since 2011, the JTEDs have been through a series of legislative cuts that started with the removal of funding for ninth grade students back in 2011 and continues until the cuts that we saw last year. All in total, that's been a 50% cut to the JTED funding at the state level over that time frame. Due to those cuts, Mountain Institute has already reduced staff in prior years from 17 full-time staff, that includes teachers, office staff, admin staff, and support staff, down to a current staff today of 9. We will see additional cuts to staff with these budget cuts if they're not repealed, as well as the closure of programs and campuses.
Given your concerns with some of the aspects of the governor's proposal, how optimistic are you that something else might emerge in the final product?
Well, I think we're very optimistic. Over the past 2 weeks, I've been down at the Capitol working with legislative leadership alongside my colleagues to educate them on the effects of the cuts across the state of Arizona, and in particular how they're going to impact JTEDs and current technical education programs. To that end, we have heard repeatedly from bipartisan leadership at the Capitol that they want to work to restore the JTED $30 million. And so we have been working very hard behind the scenes to accommodate their request, to answer their questions, and to facilitate that discussion. And I'm very optimistic that there will be a product that comes out of the legislative process here in the coming weeks that is going to be successful for JTEDs in the end. At least that's what we're hoping for.
Jeremy Plum is the superintendent of Mountain Institute JTED in Prescott. Jeremy, thank you.
Thank you so much, Mark.
The Arizona Cardinals face off with the Carolina Panthers on Sunday night with a trip to the Super Bowl on the line in the NFC title game. As KGAZZ's Phil Latzman reports, nearly three decades after making this their new home, the Cardinals may have finally arrived in Arizona.
First, an NFL history lesson. The Rams' recent decision to move back to Los Angeles has its roots here in Arizona.
Football Cardinals owner Bill Bidwell made it official today, announcing before the NFL's midnight deadline where he intended to move his franchise, and Phoenix, Arizona is the site.
We made the decision in Phoenix, and we're not going to explain why.
That's a clip from ESPN back in 1987. The reason why was attendance. The team averaged only 28,000 fans in their final season in St. Louis before becoming the Phoenix Cardinals the following season. The void would be filled in 1994 when the Rams abandoned Southern California for Missouri, only now to return. Also that year, the Cardinals adopted the more inclusive first name Arizona, and they've now been here in the Valley as long as the old team was in St. Louis. According to longtime Arizona Republic sports columnist Paula Bovin, it's taken that long for the Cards to find a fan base and an identity here in the Valley.
I think the big thing was the stadium gave it a new identity, new respect, new income. You know, that changed things a lot. But just the respect now, you go to a stadium and you don't see all the visiting team's fans there anymore. You see some, it still happens, but not like it used to be at Sun Devil Stadium.
The Cards moved from the ASU campus to their own state-of-the-art football palace in 2006, and after a couple of rough seasons, they've thrived here. They've sold out every game since moving to Glendale, making the Super Bowl in 2009, and they've now acquired multiple generations of fans who've watched some of the most memorable games in franchise history.
It's partly the NFL, and it is. It's also a group of fans who are starting to grow up watching this team win. Team players that have an identity, someone they can connect with, you know, the Larry Fitzgeralds of the world. I mean, I think all those things have just added to the relationship with this community.
And that relationship was only strengthened this past Saturday night when the Cardinals beat the Packers at home in what was easily one of the wildest games in NFL history.
Fitzgerald is going to take it into Green Bay territory. Larry Fitzgerald inside the 30, the 20.
Insane indeed, as described by Al Michaels on NBC. Moments later, it would be over as the wily 32-year-old veteran wide receiver finished off the Packers on a perfectly executed shovel pass to score the game-winning touchdown.
You know, it was a great game, hard fought, you know, going back and forth, and this playoff atmosphere, you know, that's what you're looking for.
Bovin says Arizona now has its own Larry legend in Larry Fitzgerald.
He's reinvented himself, and for him to be the key figure in this last victory is pretty remarkable, just because the team feeds off him when he succeeds, and the community loves him because there's such a humility to him.
The community of football fans in the Valley has also embraced the introverted and soft-spoken quarterback in the midst of a similar career revival, Carson Palmer.
I'm very private, as you guys know, and you guys talk about a lot. We've been so well received in this city, in this state, and the fans have been so great and gracious and welcoming.
The 36-year-old Palmer won his first ever playoff game Saturday, which leads us to the matchup itself. This Sunday's matchup is easily the former college Heisman Trophy winner's biggest as a pro.
You know, I lean on my coaches. Our coaches have been there. I lean on guys in the locker room that have been there. And as I haven't been playing in these games, I've studied it and watched it from afar and gone through it mentally as much as you can.
And Bruce Arians, trying to make the big game as a head coach for the first time, says the routine will remain the same.
This feels like any other game, really. I mean, I've been in this arena before as a coordinator, so it's not new. It's exciting, but You know, as far as the week of preparation, nothing ever changes.
But that routine will certainly change if the Cardinals win again and make their second ever Super Bowl trip with a chance at their first championship in 2 weeks in Santa Clara. In Tempe, Phil Latzman, KJZZ News.
When the Cardinals take the field, one of the players who will have a big role in their success is offensive lineman Mike Iupati. In addition to his team success, Iupati this month was also named the first ever Polynesian Pro Football Player of the Year. There are a number of players of Polynesian heritage in the NFL. A new movie looks at that and how many young men in that community dream of playing football.
We come from a line of warriors. Our culture embodies what football is.
My father pushed the football once he understood what football could do.
I think they see NFL as like kind of winning the lottery.
Tony Vainuku is the director of the film called In Football We Trust. And Tony, tell me what's behind the story.
The film is about four young teenage Polynesian kids that are striving to make it in the NFL. They're all from Salt Lake City. We follow them from their senior year as they make their way through college. So we shoot them for about 4 years. The whole film was inspired by the fact that I grew up in some of these same communities. I'm Polynesian. I played football until about my sophomore year. A lot of my cousins and uncles all, you know, wanted to make it in the NFL. I had a younger uncle that was our NFL hopeful. He was recruited nationwide. But his life took a turn for the worse. He ended up going to prison for 10 years. And so that story personally stuck with me, and I wanted to tell that story.
How did it come to pass that the NFL became such a potential dream for especially kids of Polynesian descent?
You know, our size is one thing, our size and speed. Utah and BYU were kind of the first colleges to have the secret sauce, is what they called it. Polynesians being here in Salt Lake City and Utah, you know, they were able to pull them out of their own backyard and found out real quick that they were really fast and big for their speed. And that culturally, I think Polynesians took to football really naturally. It has that camaraderie, it has that family element. And for Polynesians, that's important and, you know, just had a natural fit.
In reading about this film, it strikes me that it's in some ways maybe similar to a movie that came out a while ago called Hoop Dreams, which followed a couple of African-American kids as they sort of had dreams of playing in the NBA. Do you see a parallel between those stories?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it is, you know, it's a new culture and a new sport, but it definitely has that universal message of that Hoop Dreams has. You know, it's these kids that are trying to create an opportunity and better their lives and bring their families out of poverty with a commercial sport. But it definitely has that universal message of, you know, it's a human story. It really isn't about the sport. It's about, you know, these kids, the pressures of media attention, family and friends.
What kind of support structure is there for some of these kids and basically a reality check to say, yes, you know, if you play well, you have a shot, but in all likelihood, you're not going to play in the NFL?
Well, as you see in the film, one out of the four kids ends up not, you know, really being able to play at a level that they expected to play. So it does definitely show the reality of your chances on playing football. But football is used differently for all four kids. You know, football is used to help them stay alive. You know, two of our kids deal with gangs, and so the alternative to being on the streets is to play football. Another one of our kids is just trying to use it to go through college, and then another kid is definitely, he has the talent to go to the NFL. So football is used differently and is positive in some ways and in other ways negative.
What do you hope that people who see this film will take away from it ultimately?
You know, some of the message in the film, I hope that people are able to pull away that, you know, football could be a positive thing, but I think a lot of times they're not understanding the system completely. Our youth isn't. I think for parents, the message should be that there is sometimes often a miscommunication between their kids and what's going on in their world. But for the youth, because it is a story about the youth, I think that hopefully they can take away the fact that football can be used as a vehicle just as long as you're the driver.
Tony Vainuku is the director of the film In Football We Trust. Tony, thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Coming up, marking 25 years of an effort to preserve open space in Scottsdale.
If you realize that we have preserved a third of our landmass in the McDowell Mountains, you really look at the fact that it's a miracle.
The McDowell Sonoran Conservancy later on the show.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve. I'm Mark. In Valley traffic, US 60 eastbound, there's a crash blocking the exit ramp at Mesa Drive. It'll be partly sunny for the rest of the afternoon, but clouds could start to roll in tonight. Overnight lows in the mid-40s. Partly cloudy again tomorrow with a high of 72, 67 for a high on Sunday. It's sunny and 73 degrees at KJZZ at 224.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore of Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership, featuring the 2016 Forester with 32 mpg and enhanced safety features for anything life throws at you. Online at shopsubaru.com.
The flow of drugs across the Arizona-Mexico border is a constant battle for drug enforcement officials, but which drugs are being trafficked into the country are always changing. And right now, those drugs are meth and heroin. KJZZ's Lauren Gilger spoke with the special agent in charge of the Phoenix Division of the Drug Enforcement Administration about this, and she joins me now. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Mark.
So how does the DEA track these trends?
So the DEA tells me there's no way of knowing exactly how much of any illegal drug is being trafficked into the country, but they can follow the trends by tracking the amount of each drug that's seized on the border and throughout the state. And this year, they found a continuing rise in seizures of meth and heroin here in Arizona. In fiscal year 2015, agencies seized almost 6,400 pounds of meth here. They seized more than 1,200 pounds of heroin. And at the same time, the amount of cocaine they've been seizing has gone down.
What's behind those changes?
Well, it all has to do with the bottom line. The DEA says Mexican cartels control about 90% of the methamphetamine trade that comes into the U.S. and probably 80% of the heroin trade. But that's not the case with cocaine. Here's DEA's Doug Coleman.
We've seen that with the decrease in the actual amount of cocaine that's coming through the southwest border here because the Mexicans don't manufacture cocaine. So they actually just get a piece of a transportation fee from the Colombians and the Peruvians when that comes up. So they are less inclined now to move coke up through the southwest border and much more inclined to move meth, heroin, and weed because they control all those. They make it themselves, manufacture it themselves, smuggle it themselves. The profit for them, the profit margin for them on those three drugs is much better than the profit margin on cocaine.
And this has all had an effect on the production of drugs here in Arizona, yes?
Yes. It wasn't too long ago that you turn on the news and you'd see stories of meth labs being busted by law enforcement. There would be big explosions in normal garages. But that isn't happening nearly as much anymore. Here's what Coleman had to say about that.
We used to have a significant laboratory problem here in the United States where the actual manufacturing could happen here in the U.S. We had the super labs all through Central California, and we had a major lab issue going on in the U.S. probably 10 years or so ago. Realizing that problem, the United States passed what was called the Combat Methamphetamine Control Act, and what it did is it restricted the acquisition of significant amounts of pseudoephedrine.
Right, so this is like when we go to Walgreens to buy Sudafed, you have to go up to the counter to buy more than a little bit.
Right, yeah, if you're buying a product that contains pseudoephedrine itself, you have to go up to the counter and you have to show an identification. By putting it behind the counter like that, it stopped the mass purchasing. We used to call it smurfing, where people would go to these different Walgreens and they would buy 200 packs of Sudafed. Then they'd go to the next Walgreens and buy 200 more packs of Sudafed.
So you're finding, you said there were zero meth labs that you seized here in Arizona last year. Is that a big shift?
Well, what's happened is once the Combat Meth Act passed, the actual number of significant size laboratories decreased. Now, what ended up happening was that small gram quantity laboratories still continued, but they can only make really small quantities, just really enough for users.
So what does it mean that there were no meth labs seized here last year? Does it mean that they don't exist here at all anymore?
No, I think you'll see them pop up. We see them pop up in different parts of the country. But what it means is that the Combat Meth Act did just about eliminate major significant methamphetamine production labs.
I guess it's a victory in some way, right? Like that we passed a law and it had an immediate effect. But is it actually fixing the problem of meth abuse in this country, seeing as how it's still coming across the border?
No, I mean, that's a great question. I think the issue is did it solve the laboratory problem in the United States? It didn't solve it, but it really helped it. But you hit a great point. The reality is that Mexico does not have the same pseudoephedrine controls and precursor chemical controls that we have in the United States. So mass production switched to Mexico, and now it has to get smuggled in. So what we've done is we've solved a significant issue with the lab problem, the actual manufacturing here, but the addiction issue with methamphetamine still remains in the country, and there still is a significant amount of methamphetamine that the Mexican cartels are trying to smuggle across to feed the meth addict population in the United States.
And in a big picture sense, in terms of fighting this addiction that our country has to various kinds of drugs, what do you think really needs to be done? You can continue going after the bad guys, but is this a prevention issue? Is this an education issue?
So I think that what we have to think about as Americans is the simple fact that we will never end drug abuse, right? It's never going to end. We have a relatively small and steady portion of the country that uses drugs. That is because the strategy that we use does work. I think of it as a three-legged stool, right? There's prevention and education, there's treatment, and there's enforcement. If you take any one of those three legs off the stool will fall over. So we need to get out of the idea that we're going to make it all go away, because we're not. But we also need to get out of the idea that doing something besides what we're doing now is going to change that outcome. It's not. It's a three-legged strategy. All three have to work in tandem together to have any success and to try to maintain levels that we can live with.
Thank you so much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you very much.
That was Doug Coleman. He's special agent in charge of the Phoenix Division of the Drug Enforcement Administration. We were talking about the increase in meth and heroin seized in our state last year.
That's KJZZ's Lauren Gilger. Lauren, thank you.
Thank you.
More than 900 advocates for science, technology, engineering, and math, often called STEM, are gathering from around the country in downtown Phoenix today and tomorrow for the 21st Century STEM Integrate to Innovate Conference. A mixture of mostly teachers, corporate heads, legislators, and others will be discussing best practices in the classroom and effective methods outside the classroom to move STEM fields forward in education. Last night, KJZZ's science and innovation correspondent Andrew Bernier attended the conference kickoff event, a STEM legislative social, and he joins us now to talk about what was discussed. Andrew?
Hello, Steve.
Andrew, let's hear, first of all, Bill Harris, who I spoke to from Science Foundation Arizona, put a big emphasis on coding. You heard something about coding last night and the importance of that, right?
Yes. So Hadi Partovi, he's the founder and CEO of Code.org, and he was one of the speakers at the legislative social last night. And obviously, computer science is making waves here in the Valley, as many corporations and jobs are coming to the Valley. And you know, there's not so much the supply of those who can possibly fill those positions. So here's Partovi speaking about the challenges facing computer science programs.
It's the perception by administrators, by politicians, the idea that computer science is vocational, as if you should only be teaching it to the kids who want to get coding jobs, rather than thinking this is foundational. Understanding what an algorithm is or how an app works is equally foundational for every child, and most administrators don't recognize that.
And that was Hadi Partovi, founder and CEO of Code.org. And of course, because it was a legislative social last night, Andrew, you also had a chance to talk with some lawmakers.
One of the politicians that I caught up last night is Charlene Fernandez. She's a state representative out of District 4, which is primarily the Yuma area, and she's coming from the Democratic Party. She's thinking that there needs to be a change of pace now of where funding is currently coming from to now putting it more onto the state government to fund these computer science programs.
You can't implement these programs without funding, without the support of our state legislatures and our state government. We can only go to the private sector so much. And I mean, they have come through for us, but we can't continue to expect them to carry the full load.
And that was Representative Charlene Fernandez of the Yuma area. You also had a chance to talk with State Senator Jeff Dial. He had some points of view on this as well.
Yeah, and they were actually not too distant from Representative Fernandez. And so it's interesting how you saw these two parties kind of aligning in maybe where this funding can come from and how they both seem somewhat hopeful, if you will, that the funding from the government with some proper language to get other members on board can push these computer science programs in schools in Arizona.
It's always an issue of funding because if you want to have success, you have to fund this. And I think they said it was $5 million. That seemed very reasonable. So I don't think there's huge hurdles there, but it'll probably just be educating the members of why it's beneficial. I think locally there was one company that had 2,000 job openings in the programming area, and that's just crucial for the state.
That's State Senator Jeff Dial, who are also joined by KJZZ Science and Innovation correspondent Andrew Bernier, updating us on the STEM conference taking place in the Valley. Andrew, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
Whether it's bioscience corridors or trying to be a so-called Silicon Desert, Arizona wants to prove that making a commitment to science and research will be a major boon to the state's economy. Bill Harris, the head of Science Foundation Arizona, used to be in charge of Science Foundation Ireland, and he believes the state post-recession can learn a lot from Ireland's model and build on it. Bill, Arizona was hammered by the Great Recession. How deeply did Ireland feel it?
It hit Ireland especially hard, their real estate areas and their banking system. But they came to the conclusion that to be competitive in this century, they had to work in new ways. Despite the economic challenges that were very, very serious, they kept their investment in research and development. They knew that they had to continue to invest if they were to compete. And because of that, I think they're benefiting today from those investments and really high-quality jobs and high-quality opportunities. I think Arizona can do the same thing.
How much have we been lacking kind of an overall vision to ride through those really, really rough times? And you mentioned if Ireland sticks with it, Arizona's first thought was, I mean, obviously we got hit very hard here, but the first thought was, what do we cut? It just seemed like there wasn't even a base level of spending for things like this. How much do you think that put us behind? And how much do you think in the future to get ready for whenever the next recession is, need to be able to want to ride through some of those bumps?
Well, you know, I think it would be helpful to have a serious strategic plan or roadmap for what you're trying to achieve. I'd like our roadmap to include an ambition to be in the top half of the states in education. I don't like the debates that looks at money or looks at this or somebody says we're 49 or 48. I just think we ought to have an ambition because I think when I've talked to business leaders, major corporations that are driven by new products, driven by electronics, driven by other kinds of things, pharmaceuticals, they really need the talent. When you're talking about talent, one of the things that they do is they look at your school system. I think education has to be something that we recognize is the key to economic prosperity.
How much does the state need to lean on and how much do businesses need to collaborate with the universities here? It's been talked about that we have a limited number of universities, but the ones we have are quite large.
It's not a matter of leaning, it's a matter of incentivizing. And I think the universities are largely incentivized by the federal research grants. And the federal research grants are significant in the state of Arizona. But for the most part, the incentives there are for the faculty to do great research, discover great things, which they do. What we have to look at more carefully is how do we translate some of those research investments, again, particularly in engineering, computer science, and chemistry and physics. How do we translate some of those into an advantage for Arizona-based companies? I think you need to use some resources to incentivize this so it works. And what we did in Ireland is we made sure that anything that we did as an incentive, it had to be matched at least 1-to-1, normally 2-to-1, and we had to measure the impact.
Why is it going to work this time? Do you think a lot of it comes down to the fact that we didn't have that diverse economy before the recession, and now people are more open to this idea of, hey, we have to do impactful things now?
What people are beginning to realize is that the world has really changed. It is far more complicated. It is far more challenging than in the past. And I think a lot of people realize that we're going to be better off if we have the talent to attract industry and if we have the school system and the universities to attract industries to create the wealth. But you need government to be a partner. If government is not a partner and doesn't realize that they have an investment responsible in research, that translation will never occur. About 2 years ago, there was an NGA study that said, you know, what we have learned is that you really need, they call it an intermediary, I call it a matchmaker, but you really need somebody that operates between the industry and the universities, that understands the incentives and creates the advantage, the economic advantage for the region by coupling those things appropriately and measuring the fact that they're working.
Bill Harris, longtime head of Science Foundation Arizona. Bill, thanks as always.
Thank you very much. Good to see you.
Still to come on the show, it's just about home tour season. That and more still ahead. It's the show.
We'll stay partly cloudy through the rest of this afternoon around the valley, looking for a high temperature to reach around 73. And as luck would have it, we have reached that. Relative humidity is at 11%. It is partly cloudy, 73 degrees at KJZZ. Quick check of valley traffic. The exit ramp is blocked on the 60 eastbound by a collision at Mesa Drive. It's 239.
KJZZ is supported by ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business and the Economic Club of Phoenix Luncheon on January 28th. Harvey Cantor, CEO of web retailer Blue Nile, will discuss building an authentic brand. ecpphoenix.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lori London. A crippling blizzard is now starting to bear down on the Mid-Atlantic, where some areas are expected to get more than 2 feet of snow. The storm could impact some 50 million people along the East Coast, as forecasters call for gale force winds, coastal flooding, and whiteout conditions. Snow and ice has already caused power outages in the Deep South, where many areas are dealing with treacherous road conditions. In Tennessee, rain turned to snow much earlier than forecasters expected. Blake Farmer of member station WPLN in Nashville reports.
The way snow usually goes in this part of the country is that predictions get scaled back as the storm gets closer and a big snowfall turns into a few flurries or freezing rain. This was the other way around. Parts of Tennessee are now expecting close to 10 inches of the white stuff. Universities, government offices, and even businesses are closed. Officials are pleading with people to stay off the roads, which are covered in ice and snow. The winter weather will stick around a while. Even after the snow stops, temperatures in Tennessee aren't expected to get above freezing until Sunday. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
Air travel has come to a complete standstill in much of the East Coast, with thousands of flights canceled today and snow expected to continue into tomorrow night. FlightAware.com CEO Daniel Baker says flying through the D.C. area this weekend will not be an option.
Airlines have already canceled 2,900 flights Saturday. Effectively, all flights in and out of the D.C. area are going to be canceled. That's Reagan National, Washington Dulles, and Baltimore.
Baker says if there is a silver lining here, it's that Saturdays are the lightest air travel day of the week, which could help airlines recover quicker. On Wall Street today, stocks are back in the black after oil prices shot up 7%. The Dow closing up 210 points at 16,093. This is NPR.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. This week, Scottsdale is marking the 25th anniversary of the official effort to save a significant part of the city's open desert area. It was in 1991 that the McDowell-Sonoran Land Conservancy was formed to work to create the McDowell-Sonoran Preserve, which is now at 30,000 acres. Current Scottsdale City Councilwoman Virginia Cordy was a businesswoman when she was asked to lead a task force to look into whether preserving the area was truly viable, and she joins me now. Councilwoman, there was clearly development that was going to happen on or near the McDowell Mountains in the 1980s, but what got this effort started?
With the court case that a developer sued Scottsdale over the hillside ordinance and the environmentally sensitive land ordinance, we sued and lost, so we couldn't zone. When we realized that as a community we couldn't zone to save the McDowells, we realized we needed to buy it.
Was it a relatively slow process to get people on board?
Well, I think with any grassroots effort, it is a slow process, and it took a couple of years. But it was pretty clear when all you needed to do was take a look up at towards the McDowell Mountains that was once pristine desert, and you saw McDowell Mountain Ranch being developed and some other developments going on in the northern part, and say to our community that if we don't figure out a way to preserve this land, it's going to be gone for generations. And we have lost an opportunity to preserve open space, use as an educational tool for our community, inspiration, and a legacy for our future generations.
How unique is that to a place like Scottsdale? Was Scottsdale a pioneer to some extent in terms of the way you went about this process?
I think very much so. Scottsdale has always done things a little differently. And there are many communities, not only within Arizona, but communities in other states that reach out to the city and to McDowell's Northern Conservancy to ask, how'd you guys do it? If you realize that we have preserved a third of our land mass in the McDowell Mountains, you really look at the fact that it's a miracle. And you know, I believe in miracles. A lot of people do. And I think the McDowell Snorren Preserve is a miracle.
Now, I don't know if you use it. If you do, is there a favorite part you have?
So I love the northern part out of Browns Ranch and the old Browns Ranch site. I actually was very much involved in a revegetation project through Scottsdale Community College. And the value around the vision and the definition of our preserve is critical because it is not a park.
Is there a feeling that because of all the work that's been done over the past quarter century and even more, that what is there is safe, is set, it will be expanded? Or is there a feeling that there are still defenses to be had? That at some point, is there that feeling, though, that there is still potentially a fight on your hands? Or is this been established and it's set?
Through our ordinances, our preserve ordinances, and through the vote of the people, and we went to the vote of the people five different times, the only way that the boundary and the land that's been purchased with the preserve tax, the only way that can be changed for another purpose is to go back to the voters. So I do not believe that there is any threat to our preserve. Now we're talking about creating a Desert Discovery Center, and we're talking about placing that on the border of the preserve, in the preserve. But that really meets the intention of our voters and our citizenry to preserve those lands for this generation and future generations to enjoy and partake in the Sonoran Desert.
Virginia Cordy, she's a member of the Scottsdale City Council, was also chair of the task force that helped create the McDowell Sonoran Conservancy. Thanks very much for the time.
Thank you.
They are among the smallest of their kind with hundreds of species among them, and Arizona is the home to several. Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez tells us more.
You may have seen a few hummingbirds around the yard, and heard them too. Well, it's not unusual to have them in the valley. Did you know Arizona has the most hummingbird species in the U.S.?
Yes, by far. We've got the broad-billed, the broad-tailed, the black-chinned, the rufous, the anas. We have rarely the white-eared and rarely the barreling, but we have commonly the blue-throated, magnificent. Let's see, what else do we have? Oh, we have Lucifer hummingbird.
David Pearson is an ornithologist at the ASU School of Life Sciences.
As you get farther south towards Tucson and south of Tucson, then you can get up to 14 species coming in. And many of them are the only ones that come up from Mexico, just barely get up into Mexico. There he goes right there. Listen to him, there's two of them.
While talking outside Pearson's home in the Mesa Tempe area, a few of the birds fly around. He says there are more than 300 species of hummingbirds in the world, mostly found in tropical regions in the Americas. Over time, several moved north, and for some reason have made Arizona their home.
If you go down to the Huachucas, the Chiricahuas, or Santa Ritas in, say, late July, early August, some of the valleys there, the canyons, have got feeders up where they use up quarts and quarts of sugar water every day. There's hundreds of hummingbirds coming in.
The most commonly found hummingbirds in the valley are the anas, with red feathers around the head and neck, and the costas, with a purple cap. Local vegetation, flowers, and homes with nectar feeders have helped maintain these small birds in the region. Pearson says a feeder with plain old water and sugar will get you a visit.
Even in apartments, three or four stories up, you hang a hummingbird feeder out on your balcony, and anas are very likely to find it. Let's see if I can get them to come in. I'll try.
Okay. The sounds you hear come from the males. This one is flying around while singing. It's a mating call and dance. The female hummingbirds take a different role. They make the nest, lay and incubate the eggs, and feed the young.
Well, almost everybody's going to have a little nest. If you look carefully, it's a tiny little nest, just a little bit bigger than a thimble.
Pearson says hummingbirds are daring little things and are intrigued by the color red. So if you sit outside and wear, say, a red patch, don't be surprised if the hummingbird comes hovering around you. Don't swat it, because once it realizes it's nothing, it just flies away. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or know things we should know, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark. I'm Steve. If you left work a little bit early and looking at traffic, we have one accident to tell you about, the 60 eastbound at Mesa Drive. That off-ramp is blocked. We'll stay partly cloudy through the rest of this afternoon and on into tonight as well, and we expect lows to be in the mid-40s. Then for this weekend, partly sunny skies both tomorrow and Sunday. Look for a high of 72 tomorrow and then 67 degrees on Sunday. Currently, relative humidity is at 11%. It's partly cloudy and 73 degrees at 249.
KJZZ is supported by Crooked Sky Farms, now harvesting vegetables well-suited for juicing, such as celery, kale, and carrots. Information about their sustainable farming practices, farmers market locations, and more at crookedskyfarms.com.
Mesa's historic home tour is tomorrow. It's one of several around the valley this time of year. Mesa's event will include about a dozen homes in three of the city's historic neighborhoods. One of those homes belongs to Jeanette Hadley. She and her husband live in a two-story Craftsman bungalow in the Evergreen District. The house was built in 1919. She's lived there for more than 30 years. I chatted with her in the sitting room right off the kitchen and asked her why she decided to open her home to the tour.
Yeah, I've said no every year. So we find, in fact, we got to a place where we feel like we're almost done. I don't think you're ever done, but it feels much better having people come through without rooms you have to shut, paint cans, ladders, and everything you have to put away, because we've pretty much been living in that for a long time. So, yeah.
So what made you decide that this was something you wanted to do, to be on this home tour and frankly, have a bunch of strangers, you know, roam in your house?
Well, I had a little pressure from the people who run the tour, and she sent her neighbors in, you know, to ask us. And I started thinking about it. We were getting close to being done with this project. But I also like to go on these tours. Local historic home tours are wonderful. Been to the Phoenix ones, been to several districts here, and I enjoy it so much. And it's nice to have recognitions for the things that you've done on your house as well. So for all of those reasons.
What are your expectations about what it's going to be like on that day?
Well, because I've been on them, crowded, lots of people, lots of talking. I'm expecting to see people say, oh, I used to play at that house when I was little. And I'm hoping to get more history that way. Even now, if I say where I'm from, somebody will say, oh, I drive around your corner all the time and watch you fixing it up or whatever. But the real treasures will be when people say, you know, I've been there and this is what happened there, or tell stories about it.
So you think you might learn more about your house than what you already know?
I hope so. Yeah, I really do. I think that would be very fun and very satisfying.
What has the preparation been like? I assume you want to put your best foot forward. You don't want, you know, dishes in the sink, things like that. What has it been like these last few days getting ready for this?
Oh, interesting. So a lot of stashing in closets and, you know, putting all the clutter away, and then you put it away and you can't find it, but you know, it looks so much better when it's cleaned up like that, but you really can't live with it that way. But yeah, we've been going nuts.
It almost sounds like you feel somewhat of a sense of responsibility to show this house as a historic home in this historic neighborhood, that you want people to see it and you want people to sort of know what this neighborhood is about and what the homes look like. Am I hearing that right?
Yeah, you're right. This is historically significant. The man that built this house built many of the homes in this neighborhood. So yeah, it is. It's part of that. There's a lot of homes in the neighborhood that are being shown that I can't wait to see because of their significance, and that, you know, I'm grateful they're opening that up.
Jeanette Hadley's home is one of those that'll be featured during tomorrow's historic home tour in Mesa. One of the biggest home tours in the Valley will be in a few weeks in Central Phoenix. Daryl Collins is this year's co-chair of the Willow Home Tour. He's also had two homes on the tour in the past. Daryl, why do this?
I think in both situations, I had a very unique home. One was a Tudor, and the other was Spanish, and everybody that would walk in the house would say, oh my God, you should put this on the home tour. It's so beautiful. And, you know, you get bombarded by your neighbors that actually is
little peer pressure.
A little pressure. So I said, oh, okay, that will help me get my projects done. And it pretty much really does help you get your projects done.
So you were working on the house and you knew that you had a deadline by which you had to finish.
Once you sign up for the tour, because, you know, you're going to be in the brochure and it's going to be printed. They've already come over and taken pictures. And so it was just, it really is just a lot of pressure to get it all done. And you know, all the details. Yeah.
Did you have any apprehension beforehand of all these strangers walking through your house?
You know, I actually kind of, I don't want to say the word interviewed, but I spoke to homeowners that had previously been on tour. One of the questions, of course, was, were you missing anything after the tour? Did you get broken into anytime after the tour? Or, you know, because you're kind of, you know, you're concerned with, you know, we have 4,000 people coming through our tour, and that's a lot of people in your house in 6 hours, you know. So yeah, I did at first, but after the first experience, I was really excited for the second round. And there's nothing better than actually after you do all this work, someone coming through and patting you on the back and saying, wow, this is great. Look at this. It looks so wonderful. And so,
I mean, clearly you had a good experience if you did it again in another house. I mean, can you describe what it was like to have all these people? I'm sure some were your neighbors and some were people who came from other places that you didn't know.
Right.
What was that experience like?
Like I said, it's you really feel good about what you've done and how well you've renovated the house and brought it to its charm that it is, and because everyone recognizes it and they can see all the hard work you've done. So it pays off at the end because you're like, oh, somebody appreciates all this work you do. And I think that's the biggest part of it, is the payback is all the compliments.
In an age when, you know, you can get a street-level view of pretty much any house, you can, for a lot of homes, especially those that have been on the market, you can get a virtual tour. You can see so much of a home without having to actually go to the house. Do you think the role or the purpose of these home tours has evolved in some way?
You're right. I'm being a realtor that I do know that you can, you know, you can now get pictures of anybody's house pretty much, or take Google and, you know, Google Earth, and you can go walk down the street and look at everybody's house. But there's nothing like actually walking into and getting that feel of a 1920s or 1930s house. It's when you walk in that you really, you know, get the feel of the arc. When you see how everything is built back then, and especially if you're coming from the suburbs, you look and you say, wow, look at what they did back then. And to know that this was hand-carved, you know, the wood, and whoever still has original cabinetry in their kitchens and things like that, you're just like, wow, that's impressive, you know, to see, because you don't see it anymore.
Daryl Collins lives in the Willow Historic District and is co-chair of this year's home tour, which will take place the weekend of February 13th.
A local theater company is teaming up with two composers from New York to create a collaborative performance piece in just a week. The show's Annika Klein dropped by Orange Theater during a rehearsal to watch their process.
33 degrees 27-47.2 north at 1.
Maps. That single word provided the starting point for the collaboration. And from there, the group doesn't quite know where they'll end up. That's what they're excited about. Matthew Watkins is the artistic director of Orange Theater and says there's a lot to unpack out of the word maps.
We chart not just how to get from one place to another, but what it means to be in that place, the history of that place for us. We all have emotional connections. Did a good thing or a bad thing happen?
We're talking inside Orange Theater, inside the wooden frame of a house. It's a set design left over from a previous show. There's even a toilet and a bathtub. And like this house, the performance piece is unfinished. Paul Pinto is founder of Thing NY, a music collective in New York. He says this whole thing is an experiment.
The experiment is we don't know what exactly the result will be when composers, performers, directors, dramaturgs, and designers work in the same room to create something where everyone has an equal stake in what the performance is going to be.
Even the script is subject to change at any moment. The actors read off tablets and laptops. It's being created by everyone, informed by personal experience and memory.
Stuff like that glass bird you once threw at me, you remember that?
I remember.
That wasn't a question.
Corinne Martinez is a performer with Orange and says the theme made her think back to a time before modern maps.
I got to thinking about and sharing a bit about my family, who is five generations deep in Arizona and was here before it was part of the United States.
As the group explores the idea of maps, they're also exploring uncharted territory in theater. While the actors set up for rehearsal, Pinto gives them another new idea to try.
The option to read the stage direction as opposed to do the stage direction was something we actually are interested in you trying.
Gets up and goes to book, opens book, flips several pages, finds something of interest.
Imagine a GPS telling you, you could turn left, or turn right, or go straight up, whatever you feel like. And with real-time sound effects and music added to the mix, the result is something different with every read-through. Here's Matthew Watkins.
The point is not to put up shows as quickly as possible to get as many butts in seats. The point is to advance the field.
In other words, it's about the journey and the destination.
Yeah. That was cool.
It's the show. I'm Annika Klein.
And you can navigate your way to Orange Theater to see that performance tonight.
Well, if that performance isn't your cup of tea, plenty of other stuff to do this weekend. You can check out jazz performer Liz Wright. She'll be at MIM in Phoenix tonight.
And Mark, if you're an American woman and you're using these eyes, you might want to go see Burton Cummings, former lead singer for the band that did those songs, the Guess Who. He's at Wild Horse Pass Hotel and Casino tonight.
I'm impressed you knew that. How do you know that?
Yeah, I'm not going to talk about how old we are or anything like that. That's not for air, Mark. Thanks.
Sorry. The Suns host the Atlanta Hawks tomorrow evening at Talking Stick Resort Arena. Also, you can check out the Coyotes. They'll be taking on the LA Kings tomorrow night at Gila River Arena.
And Desert Stages Theater in Scottsdale hosts Thoroughly Modern Millie, the musical, tonight and tomorrow night.
The show was produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Annika Klein, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Regina Revazova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are the digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer. News director Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban.
We do want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know about good story ideas. We're at the show at kjzz.org. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is member-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. We hope you have a great weekend. It's 3 o'clock.